you know, given our financial situation, some have said, you know, can we really afford to do this project? And I guess I'd say, can we really afford not to do this project?
Governor Walker returns from Asia, optimistic about the gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the city of Anchorage prepares to deal with a big budget gap.
We actually identified which departments, you know, how many people, whether they're filled or they're unfilled, and it's a combination of both.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Governor Bill Walker's administration wants to borrow money to pay for public workers' pensions by selling up to $3.3 billion in what are known as pension obligation bonds. But as APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, the plan is drawing concern from lawmakers who say it may be risky.
Alaska's government is obligated to pay public workers $6 billion more in future pensions than it has in assets. State Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says the best way to close that gap is to sell pension obligation bonds. During a Senate Finance Committee meeting Thursday, Hoffbeck said the state would pay less than 4% interest per year for the bonds.
Your returns are not within your control, but your cost of debt is, and we have a historically low cost of debt.
The bonds are essentially low-interest debt. The state would use that money to invest. If investment returns are higher than the bonds rate, then the state would save money. A 2008 law allows the administration to issue the bonds without legislative approval, but the legislature would have to decide to spend the money to pay off the bonds. Wasilla Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy questioned why the administration planned to sell the bonds at a time when the legislature is out of session and in the middle of an election campaign.
You know, many times we as individuals, we do more due diligence on buying a toaster than we do on such money movement of such a magnitude that we do in the state. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Hoffbeck says the timing is due to low interest rates, and he cautioned against waiting any longer, since interest rates have risen since earlier in the summer. He says that if legislators say they won't appropriate the money, the state may not find buyers for the bonds. Dunleavy asked for more time to weigh the proposal.
There are some that say that just by having this discussion will cause uncertainty amongst those dealing with the bonds, and the interest rates may go up. My reply to that is there should be scrutiny. And anyone that's not asking the questions that are in a similar position that I am, they need to be asking the questions.
Pension obligation bonds have drawn criticism nationally. The Government Finance Officers Association says they involve considerable investment risk. It recommends against state and local governments issuing the bonds, since investing the money may not earn more than the bond payments. Association Director Stephen Gauthier told the Finance Committee the bonds have a history in recent decades of failing to benefit governments.
They frequently fail. Matter of fact, until 2009, most of them failed. Now there's more winners than losers, but still it's a pretty risky business. And it often attracts governments who are in the least position to take those kind of risks.
The Department of Revenue projects the state will save slightly more than $1 billion over the 23-year life of the bond if investments earn 7%. Hoffbeck says if everything goes according to plan, the bonds will be priced the week of October 24th, with bond sales closing the week of October 31st. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Governor Walker and several of his energy advisors returned this week from Singapore and South Korea. The trip comes as the state's lead partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, are backing out of the Alaska LNG mega project, and the state is preparing to take over. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
Governor Bill Walker says over the last 10 days, his team had 20 meetings with ambassadors from Japan, Qatar, Singapore, and others. They're working to raise awareness and market the $45 to $65 billion Alaska LNG project. And while they didn't return with any firm commitments to buy into the project, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation President Keith Meyer says the team made progress.
I would say we moved the ball quite a bit. Now, we didn't sign MOUs, and we're a little ways from that. What we're doing now is raising awareness, also correcting, as the governor indicated, correcting some misperceptions out there that the project had stopped. There were some bad headlines that preceded us.
As the state seeks buyers for North Slope Natural Gas, it must also continue with the regulatory process of permitting the massive project. And it's unclear exactly how much that's going to cost. Meyer says the team is working on budget scenarios for different levels of activity, including further engineering work. Though he says that work takes a lower priority to getting permits and finding funding for the project. Walker says he confirmed in several meetings that it's still possible to complete the project by 2025. Walker and Meyer say they're aiming to get firm commitments and contracts from buyers within a year. It's unclear if the state will move into the next phase of the project, which would require financing an estimated $2 billion in final engineering and design plans. The state's financial resources are strained with multi-billion dollar deficits, and it's not clear if the legislature would continue appropriating funding for the project. But Walker says he thinks the legislature is just as focused on selling the state's gas as his administration.
You know, given our financial situation, some have said, you know, can we really afford to do this project? And I guess I say, can we really afford not to do this project?
Walker plans to be in Asia again in November, where he'll speak in Tokyo. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Anchorage, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Officials in Anchorage are preparing for a $35 million budget gap caused by a drop in state support and growing expenses for the city's workforce. During a meeting today, the administration offered its plan to close that gap with a combination of property taxes, cuts to nearly every city department, and dipping into a small budget surplus from last year.
We won't be able to afford everything that we'd like to do, so we're really going to have to make some tough choices.
Lance Wilbur directs the Office of Budget and Management for the city. He says part of the proposed plan is trimming positions and budgets from within each city department. Those range from as little as $9,000 cut from the Public Works Department to nearly $1 million drop in the Fire Department's budget. Wilbur says the reductions proposed at this early stage in the process are a preliminary attempt by the administration to figure out where it can shed jobs and cost.
We actually identified which departments, you know, how many people, whether they're filled or they're unfilled, and it's a combination of both.
One of only two departments to grow is the Anchorage Police Department, up about $3 million from the addition of dozens of new officers. The administration is on pace to fulfill a campaign promise from Mayor Ethan Berkowitz to rebuild the force to more than 400 officers. But now the bills are due. The larger department makes up the biggest share of the growth in this year's budget, which is up a little over 1% from last year to $502 million. Officials in Anchorage are getting creative with finding extra revenues. This budget proposal includes a modest increase in property taxes. The owner of a $300,000 home can expect to pay $46 more on their tax bill. They're anticipating tax revenues on cannabis, a dividend from the trash utility, and using $9 million left over from a budget surplus last year. But there's also the gradual retreat in state services. The state is preparing to reduce snow plowing for state-owned roads in Anchorage, which leaves municipal officials expecting they'll have to cover more of them, but with fewer staff.
It's not that they're not going to get done, and I think we tried to express that in there. It's not that service is going away, it's just going to take a little longer to do and provide.
Instead of plowouts taking 72 hours, Wilbur says it's likely to be closer to 80. The administration and assembly will spend the next 6 weeks ironing out details before a final budget is approved in mid-November. An Anchorage assembly member has introduced a bill that could radically reshape the taxicab industry in Alaska's largest city. Fiscal conservative Bill Evans, who represents South Anchorage, is pushing a measure that would nearly double the number of cabs over the next 5 years. After those 5 years, there'd no longer be a fixed number of cab permits. Evans compared the application process to getting a fishing license. Anyone eligible can apply. Evan says the goal of the ordinance is to make the taxi industry more competitive and improve service to customers. Many residents in the farther areas of the municipality, like Eagle River and South Anchorage, complained publicly 2 years ago about the scarcity and expense of cabs when the startup company Uber was trying to establish a presence. The measure has a long way to go before it's introduced Tuesday, and Evans expects it to attract fierce resistance from the taxi industry in the weeks and months ahead. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, allegations of funds embezzled from the Naknek Electric Association.
Hopefully the state will follow through and prosecute this individual so that it sets an example that we don't tolerate that sort of thing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Naknek Electric Association says hundreds of thousands of dollars were embezzled over several years by a former employee. At least $400,000 of that has been paid back. But some of the co-op's members want to see a criminal prosecution. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more from Bristol Bay.
About 20 co-op members showed up for the August NEA board meeting to hear the latest, which for most members was not enough. NEA Board President Nancy Morris-Lyon explained that the board is moving carefully through the process.
It is the advice of our attorney that we, you know, we, in the interest of looking out for the board and NEA itself, we don't want to make claims that we have not been able to prove yet to stay clear of defamation of character suits in the future.
The former manager in question, not named by NEA during its meetings, is Donna Vukic, who held the job for some 18 years. Vukic worked for the association prior to that as well. She retired in March of 2016 and is currently in her husband's home country of Croatia. But she has since made two lump sum payments back to NEA, described here by current manager Diane King.
There was a payment made of $237,000, the first payment made to NEA. The second one was $168,000.
That's $405,000 that's now been paid back to Naknek Electric. It was made clear during the meeting that that amount is not the full amount that was embezzled, but what the difference is has not been disclosed. King and Morris-Lyon were asked by a co-op member in the audience how far back the books had so far been audited.
We've gone back to through 2014, and now we're going back as far as 2010. Completely.
And will we continue back? If something is found, will we continue to keep going back?
Absolutely.
Naknek Electric's members are furious about the stolen funds and also upset by what may be a lack of criminal prosecution. Board President Nancy Morris-Lyon said a federal investigator had already taken a look and declined to prosecute the case, and that the board was moving cautiously towards turning it over to the state.
We've been advised against it at this point until we know exactly where we're at, because if we do move forward with any legal procedures, we again risk NEA, the membership, the board, in defamation lawsuits. Once we do decide that we've concluded the investigation, have our numbers confirmed, at that point we will be able to choose to move forward or not move forward.
Some of the members accused the board of just trying to get the co-op's money back and cover up the theft, the kind of deal they say lots of criminals would like to get.
If you get caught stealing from a bank and you give the money back, you still go to jail.
That's Fred Pike, a longtime member of the Bristol Bay community. He says he and others will lean hard on the board to take the completed forensic audit and put it into the hands of a state prosecutor.
Hopefully the state will follow through and prosecute this individual so that it sets an example that we don't tolerate that sort of thing in our small communities.
Vukic spearheaded NEA's failed attempt to produce geothermal energy, a costly endeavor that was started back in the late 90s. The project eventually failed, and NEA settled tens of millions in debt through bankruptcies. Vukic retired from NEA this past spring. The misappropriated funds were discovered in a joint effort by her successor and the independent auditors. Attempts to reach Vukic for comment for this story have not been successful. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska got close to a royal visit this week. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Prince William and Kate Middleton were met by a large crowd, music and dancing in Carcross. The event was part of a larger tour around the Yukon after traveling through British Columbia. KHNS's Abby Collins has more.
We as a people have struggled for generations and for years and years, and we're finally coming out of the other side of it, so to speak.
Andy Carville is the chief of the Yukon's Carcross Tagish First Nation.
You know, we're rebuilding our culture through songs and performances.
He spoke at a traditional ceremony welcoming Prince William and Kate Middleton to the small Yukon community of around 300 people on a crisp, sunny day.
The majority of the First Nations in the Yukon have settled. We are a government, and we're asking that you assist us and help us to continue to build that relationship with the Crown.
The royal couple was greeted with joyful dancing and singing, a performance by the Dakka Kwan dancers, and another by a children's dance group. Carville was joined by First Nations chiefs from across the territory, the Grand Chief and the Premier, among other local dignitaries. Visitors came from around the Yukon, and some from Alaska. Amidst the merriment, Carville spoke about serious issues affecting First Nations people.
We still have obstacles before us that we continue to battle on behalf of our people for the protection of our land, protection of our waters, the clean air that we breathe.
He says he's optimistic that the Carcross Tagish First Nation that has been established for 10 years will have the support to work through those obstacles.
For those, like the children that are dancing and carrying on our songs and our cultures, and those yet unborn, it's very important to us to continue to work together to get that recognition as a government.
Ryan McDougall is part of the dance group that greeted the royal couple. He says the visit is about education.
It means about educating people who, like the royals and that, about our cultural ways and who we are as a sovereign people and how we need to share our cultural ways and our songs, our histories, and our dance. And so that we can view each other as being equal and everything.
There was a serious message at the core of the royal visit, but for many, it was just plain fun to see royalty so close to home.
This is an epic trip.
Nancy Spear is from Juneau. She came to Carcross with her friends Nan Saldi from Skagway and Kathy Madsen from Haines, where the three started their journey. Here's Saldi.
And left the boat harbor at 4:30 to get to Skagway by 7 so we could hit the border right when it opened.
Spear says it's really exciting to see the Duke and Duchess in the Yukon.
That they would come to such a, you know, small place and that they value the beauty of our area.
Kathy Sheardown is from Whitehorse and carries a photo album with her. It has pictures of previous generations of the royal family visiting the Yukon.
I think it's great they always include the North within their visits, because quite often we feel left out or separate from the rest of Canada, but this proves we're not, I guess.
The royal day in Carcross included a visit with a master carver, a trip to Montana Mountain to cheer on mountain bikers, and a meeting with members of a program that employs young people to build trails. William and Kate also stepped on board the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad. While the royal couple was only in Carcross for a short time, it's clear those few hours had a meaningful impact on the community, as people young and old came out to celebrate and welcome the regal guests to their home. Reporting in Carcross, I'm Abby Collins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Christmas in October. We know it's early for a Christmas story, but the world's best choir is planning a free concert in Anchorage. The Gracias Choir and Orchestra will bring its unique flavor of Christmas here next week. And as Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, the family-friendly show depends on a network of enthusiastic volunteers to make it happen.
Julie Pack has got her running shoes on. The UAH student is one of the volunteer organizers helping to produce the Gracias Choir show at Anchorage's Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. And she dashed from a late class to publicize the event. Julie can't help but blurt out that the choir took first place in last year's choral competition in Germany.
They have never won second place. It's always been first place prize. Last year, it was the biggest choral competition in Marktoberdorf, Germany, and they won the grand prize out of all the choirs. And so that's why we were able to say boldly that they are the world's best choir.
Awards from Italy, Switzerland, and South Korea are on the choir's wall as well. When you think Gracias Choir, think TV's Glee, with lush sets, brilliant costumes, and unbounded youthful energy on an international scale. That's a traditional south of the border tune, but don't be surprised that the singers are not Mexican. They're actually Korean. You see, the Gracias Choir originated in South Korea and is affiliated with the International Youth Foundation, a Christian-based but non-denominational nonprofit that works with youth around the world.
As volunteers of this foundation, we do Mexico English camps. And so we go to Mexico, and I personally have gone 5 times to Mexico to teach English, and this year will be my 6th time during winter break.
Julie says her link to IYF is through an Anchorage church. So the Mexico-Korea connection resulted in the choir's name, Gracias, which means thanks in Spanish.
They are called the Gracias Choir because they sing out of their hearts, and so they want to sing to bring joy to other people.
Volunteers like Julie have been passing out free tickets and brochures to advertise the upcoming Anchorage performance. The October show is all about the Christmas season. It's a lavish stage production with acts centered on the traditional story of Jesus' birth. The program presents simple solos of well-known Christmas songs, too, along with a thundering rendition of Handel's best-known work. There are 120 people in the orchestra and choir, and every one of them is a volunteer. The tour and stage production are fully funded through donations.
진짜 그라시아스 합창 단액 한타타거든요. 한 사람 한 사람이 다.
Choir member Gyeongsu Park says everyone puts their whole heart into it to come up with ideas for the show.
저도 상상치 못했던 많은 이야기들이 나오고 그래서.
Julie Pack says the choir sends a powerful message to young people.
This choir didn't start off professionally. They started in a small room with 9 people. They wanted to bring joy to other people's hearts through this music. And they had the dream, that one dream, that they could be one day the world's best choir, that they are the world's best choir.
She says going toward a dream with determination can fulfill that dream. The Gracias Choir Christmas Cantata show plays October 4th and 5th at Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage. The show is free, but get there early, as it is first come, first serve. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Andrew Freed in Anchorage. Freed is a UAA student and moved to Alaska 12 years ago from Mississippi.
There was definitely more of a culture shock from me going from Anchorage to Kotzebue than moving from Mississippi up to Anchorage, Alaska. Well, I've been to COTS once, and it's sometimes you forget you're in America. The way the houses are built are different, and, you know, it's not like you can go to this large shopping area here and there. They've been a people for about ever, but then the past 200 years, they've just been trying to integrate them in these school systems, and they're kind of having, you know, trouble with that, and versus, oh, we're just, you know, coming out here as subsistence living, fishing for, you know, what we eat and whatnot. Anchorage is not what you see on TV when they talk about Alaska. That's not Anchorage, no. Anchorage is like just another smaller American city. Up here, everybody knows one another. So it's just like, okay, you know this person. Oh, I can already assume, and with the help of Facebook, that we have 4 or 7 people in common that we know. So just off the bat. Whenever I go somewhere, like, oh, I'm going to see somebody I know. It's not a matter of if, it's just who, you know. I don't even countless amounts of different cultures up here in the city and in our community. And I mean, they all, for the most part, have some form of representation. It's something we can, you know, take from each culture and learn from and, you know, enjoy. And that's kind of the joy of having a diverse culture like we have up here. There's definitely something about Alaska, and particularly Anchorage, that's always going to feel like home. I don't think I'll stay here and make this my home base, at least for now. You know, I don't know what the future holds, but I'll definitely be leaving, but I think there's always going to be a part of me that, you know, wants to come back here a little bit.
Andrew Freed lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ellen Lockyer and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Rasha McChesney in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Abby Collins in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.